Well, last week, Pastor Brandon took us through chapters 1 and 2 of Exodus, and within those passages, we saw the 400 years of oppression that the Israelites were under the Egyptians, and we saw Pharaoh, who is one of the most vile characters that we meet throughout all of Scripture, and the way he was oppressing the Israelite people. Moses is born, he's miraculously rescued, he's brought up in the king's court, in the home of Pharaoh himself, and God prepares him all the way through. God hears their groaning, it says at the end of chapter 2. He knows what Israel is going, what the Israelites are going through, and he has raised up Moses for a time just as this. Moses goes out to Midian, and he marries, he works the flocks there throughout that countryside, and that brings us into chapter 3 where we are this morning. Now, one of the things that we've changed a little bit for this week is, as you'll notice in your bulletin, there's the sermon note page that you'll find within there. There's a few different questions and answers, or ways you can answer these questions, things you might be thinking about through the sermon. So feel free to grab one of those and take some notes as we go through these series. You might use these in your life groups as well. Either your life group may be going through this, or else they may use it as an icebreaker at the beginning of their life group. So you'll want to keep track of that. It's hole punch, so if you want to put it in a binder, we have made that handy for you as well. The other thing I'll mention is that if you want to get your kids for the baptism, there will be an opportunity to do that at the end of my message. You can go downstairs. They're ready for you to pick up their kids a little bit early if you want to bring them up for the baptisms. That'll happen right at the end of the message this morning. So here we go, briefly through Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 to 15 this morning. I don't know if you've ever noticed that you can know someone your entire life, but not really know all that much about them. There's probably people who you have known for years and years and years, and you could be hard-pressed to answer maybe 5 questions about that person. There's probably people that you might see here at church each week or every so often. Maybe there's people that you work with. Maybe there's people you go to school with. And you have been with them for significant chunks of time, but you really are not that intimately involved with them, and you don't know a whole lot of what's going on in their life, nor do they of yours. You'd be hard-pressed to answer questions about them. But then there's also circumstances that you might find yourself in where you learn a whole lot about a person. I mean, you can go on a camping trip or a vacation with someone or with a family, and you'll learn a lot about them and what they're like and what their habits are and how they get along. You could become roommates with someone at college, and some of our young people have just gone off to school, and they have roommates, some of them from different parts of the world, and they're getting to know them on a really deep and intimate level. Sometimes you could even go to a funeral, and it might be someone that you've known for a while, but through the testimonies that are given as they share about their life and even as they show pictures of their family life and their friends throughout the years, you go away feeling you know them so much better than you did before. Well, this is the experience that many of us have with God. For God, to many of us, he's someone that we've known for a long period of time, but we don't really know him all that well. Hopefully for others of us, we know him very well. And he is intimately involved in our lives, and through his word and the way he has revealed himself to us, we are deeply connected and knowledgeable about him. But this is not the experience that everybody has. They've lived with him for years. They've had a casual relationship with him, but yet they do not know him. And sometimes we might say things like, I think God would be okay with this. And meanwhile, it's contrary to everything and in every way that God has revealed himself to us in his word. This passage right here, these 15 verses, they tell us so much of who God is. They are so deeply, deeply personal and intimate and revealing of who God is. And what we find in this passage is that who God was for Moses is who God is for us. This is our story in these pages, as we've been saying over the last few weeks. And 4 things that we want to quickly look at this morning is that God is the one who demands our attention. He is the one who sees us. He is the one who is present. And he is simply and profoundly the one who is. If you look at verses 1 to 4, we see the one who demands our attention. Take a look at those verses if you have your Bible. Now, we're sort of in the fire season right now. This is the time of year when we love to have fires. It's the perfect temperature for it. I always find it really interesting to see our fascination with fires. I mean, when I was a kid, you used a fire to, like, cook a wiener or, like, to maybe stay warm if you were desperately cold, but you didn't really have them for fun. I don't know, maybe it's because I grew up in Saskatchewan. Maybe it was something about that. But nowadays, fires are social events. I mean, if you build a nice fire while you're camping, you're going to have every drunk person from 10 sites around stumbling over and introducing themselves to you and gathering around your fire. It's a kind of a neat communal event. You walk down an aisle at Canadian Tire right now, and you will find 30 different options for outdoor fireplaces. We used to use tractor rims when we wanted to make a fire, but now it's this whole thing. Fires are very attractive. Fires do one of two things. Either they really attract us to them, or else they terrify us. And they are sort of both and. A fire attracts us, but it also terrifies us. Because we know the power that is within a fire, and it could be something that we stand in fear of, which is a good fear. Now here we have Moses, and he's walking around Mount Sinai, and he's watching over his father-in-law's flocks when he spots this burning bush. And what was strange was that actually this bush was not burning up. It was burning, but it wasn't burning up. And of course, there was this angel of the Lord there, which we find was God himself in the flame. So it's this crazy scene that Moses stumbles upon, a bush that is burning but isn't burning, and there is the presence of God himself. And that gets Moses' attention, and he turns to look at it, to give his attention to where this was coming from. And it says in verse 4 that when the Lord saw that he had Moses' attention, he began to speak. You see, God demands our attention. He is the God that we cannot ignore. But the problem is that we're so often distracted that we don't see him. We aren't paying attention. We aren't looking for him. We are so preoccupied, when he appears, we can miss it. But then there's those times, and maybe you've had this experience, where you just cannot miss what God is doing. There are times when God grabs your attention and we sit up straight with our eyes wide open, or we fall to our knees in awe. Have you had that experience? You know, it doesn't need to be a big thing, but God does need to get your attention. And it is when God gets Moses' attention and he turns to him to listen that God begins to speak. And it says, when the Lord saw that Moses turned to him, he spoke. Is God trying to get your attention? Have you turned yourself to see him? Are you postured before God to listen? Or are you too preoccupied for him to get your attention? Because no one can ignore God's calling forever. There will come a time, whether we like it or not, when he will have your attention. And better to do that now than later. Have you turned to him to listen? Have you done that today? This week? This month, even this year. You know, today we're going to hear the testimonies of three people who have turned their attention to God, and he spoke, and it was clear. We also see in these passages that God is the one who sees all. So now God introduces himself to Moses, and we're going to come back to that introduction later, but he tells Moses that he has seen his people's affliction. He has heard their cries, and he knows their suffering. And now he's about to do something about it. Imagine that. They had 400 years of suffering. 400 years, generations upon generations of suffering. And they remembered, there were promises that were made to their forefathers, promises that were made to Abraham, that they would be this great people. There was this promise of land, but nothing. 400 years of Egyptian captivity. But it says, and it even said at the end of chapter 2, that God saw all of this that was going on. He saw it all. It says that he heard it all, and he knew it all. And now the time had come. You see, it is an all-encompassing knowing that God speaks of here. He saw, he heard, and he knows. He hasn't forgotten their suffering, and all of their suffering has not gone unnoticed. As you remember back in chapter 2, verses 24 to 25, we're told that God heard their groaning. He remembered his covenant with their forefathers. He saw them and he knew. And God's timing was at play all along. You see, this is a great comfort to us in our suffering because God always knows. None of your suffering is wasted. This is one of the wonderful things of being in relationship with God and of knowing him is that we understand that the suffering that we walk through is never wasted. God sustained his people, and he grew them into a great nation during those 400 years. A nation that was so great that Pharaoh began to get nervous. These people are becoming too numerous. They're becoming too procreative. There's so many of them. What are we going to do with all of these people? And he started to put on the boundaries around them and tried to constrain them because they were becoming more and more numerous. 400 years of seemingly silent. And he is doing something in your suffering as well. Your suffering is never wasted. It is never for no reason. We can have complete assurance of that because of his name. And we'll get into that in just a moment. But some of you have been suffering for a long time. Some of you, you feel as though God is distant, like he's not listening. Is he even there? Like there's no hope in even calling out to him anymore. We get to these times of desperation and we wonder, is it still worth it? Is God hearing? Is he even there? Remember this. Know these stories. For 400 years, the Israelites cried out to God, and all along it says he heard their groaning and he was working. Do not stop praying. Do not stop worshiping. God sees you, he hears you, and even deeper than that, it says that he knows what you are experiencing. He is the one who sees all. Verses 8 to 12 show us he is also the one who is present. He says, I've come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land. And in verse 12, he says, I will be with you. See, in verse 8 saying that he has come down, in verse 12 saying, I will be with you, God's promise of his presence is astounding. You see, God has not grown absent. He has rolled up his sleeves to get stuck in our story. He's going to rescue people so that he can bring them into a good and a spacious land that he has promised. The theological term for this view of God is immanence. And only in Christianity do we worship a God who is both transcendent and immanent. He is this God who sees all. He is above all. He is in that way unapproachable, but he is also completely transcendent. You see, the God of Islam is what we would call transcendent, as opposed to immanent, sorry. He is out there, but he doesn't affect our lives. He's out there, but he doesn't really have a whole lot to do with me. He doesn't see, he doesn't hear, he doesn't know. He hasn't come down. But our God, Jehovah, has. God is both above us and he is also among us. And Jesus is the one who has perfectly fulfilled this. He carried this through, and this promised presence is still found in him. See, in Matthew chapter 1, we are told the birth account of Jesus in verse 23, and there we are told that Mary would have a son, and his name would actually be called Emmanuel, which means God with us. Literally, he would come down to deliver us. This was prophesied long ago, all the way back to Isaiah. In Isaiah chapter 7, we are told about this. We see it happening here at the beginning, and it's a story that we see unfolding all through Scripture from beginning to end. God was not going to be a God who was just only transcendent. He was also going to be a God who was imminent. He'd be a God who would come down, who would live among us, and do for us what we could not do for ourselves. He is both above us, and he is among us. And then in Jesus' final words recorded in Matthew 28, he says this, Behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. So he came down, but then his presence is consistently with us until the end age when he returns. He says, I am with you always. That means God is present in your life today. That means that he is with you. He is sustaining you, and nothing you are going through is lost. He is working his plan of redemption through you even now, even though you may be suffering. It was 400 years of that the Israelites persevered through, and all the while God was present and he was working. And finally, the fourth one is he is the one who simply is. I am who I am. is how he reveals himself to Moses here. This is the word, this is the terminology that he refers to himself as. So God tells Moses that he's supposed to go to the people of Israel. He's supposed to let them know that they are going to be delivered from their slavery. And Moses said, well, when they ask me who sent you, what am I to say? What is his name? What should I say? And God said, I am who I am, has sent me to you. And in that name, God reveals so much about who he is. See, this is the translated verb of Yahweh, Yahweh or Jehovah, and God is saying, I will be who I will be, or I am who I always have been. I was from the beginning who I am now and who I always will be. I do not change. Who I was then is who I am now, and it's who I always will be. I was there from the beginning. I will be there in the end, and I transcend all of time, and I never change. It means that God is self-existent. He isn't dependent upon anything or anyone. It means that he is the creator and he is the sustainer of all things. And he is eternal, from eternity past to eternity future. So therefore, when God makes a promise, it cannot be broken, because by his very nature, by his very name, it is impossible for him to lie and to make a claim that does not come true. By his very nature, his promises can never fail. So when he makes a covenant with us, like he had done with Abraham and with their forefathers, it is for our benefit and it's not for his. The covenants and the promises that he makes are always for our benefit. He already knows that he will keep it perfectly, though we struggle to. But he assures us of that fact. And even when we don't keep our end of the covenant, God always keeps the covenant. What a comfort to God and to God and the Israelites to hear God reveal himself to them through his name. They are safe, they are protected, and the promise is being fulfilled because of who he is. And this means a couple of things. First of all, this means that we don't define God, but yet we try to. So we'll sometimes say things like, I don't think that God is listening, or I don't think that he hears me, or I don't know if God can protect me, or I don't know if he can keep my life, or I don't think God would mind me doing this thing, or I don't think God would mind me believing this thought or accepting this worldly pattern. But you see, these things are not up to us to decide. We don't make a God of our own understanding and a God of our own making. It sort of reminds me a little bit of the Buddhist or Hindu parable of the blind man and the elephant. Have you ever heard this parable before? Some of you may have heard this before, but it's where each man, they're blindfolded and they touch one part of the elephant. And one guy feels the side of the elephant, and you would conclude, well, an elephant must be a wall. One guy touches the trunk and he concludes, well, it must be a snake or a rope or something like that. Another guy touches the tusk and concluded it must be a spear, and so on and so on. And the great wisdom from this is that you need the experience of all religions and worldviews to come together and to find the truth. But the problem with this is that there has to be someone who is looking at the big picture who can determine, in fact, what is true. Someone does need to see, and someone needs to claim that what is true and what is not. There is someone that needs to see the whole elephant and who can determine if they are in fact correct. Plus, what if the elephant can speak and tell you what he is? Trevin Wax of the Gospel Coalition puts it this way. He said, if God speaks, this changes everything. All contrary opinions are silenced. All conjectures are put to rest. God has made himself known, giving us a standard by which to measure all other religious claims. The parable of the blind men does not take this possibility into account. Yet three of the great world's religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, all make this claim. You see, the truth is that we do not define God through our own blindness, but rather God defines himself to us and has given it to us so clearly through his word. This means a second thing as well. We don't define God, but it also means we are defined by God. See, in verse 11, Moses asks what would be a very reasonable question to ask. He says, who am I that I should do this thing? You see, Moses feels inadequate because of his weakness, because of Pharaoh's power, and also because of the scale of this task. He said, who am I to do this thing? Who am I? See, modern culture invites us to ask this all of the time. Our identity has really become fluid. You see, centuries ago, we were defined by our family of origin, or we were defined where we lived, or we were defined by the job that we did, or we were defined by what your mother or your father also did. Now we switch careers so regularly. We move around. We join subcultures. We have online identities. You know, this can all be very anxiety-producing because we seek to re-identify ourselves time and time again. Where does our true identity lie? You see, the breakdown of families and belief in God means we have become the measure of our own lives. Identity has become something that you can achieve rather than something you receive. And all the while, this has done nothing but produce more anxiety and worry and trouble and strife. Anxiety through trying to achieve. But here, God gives Moses his identity. Moses asks, "Who am I?" Moses' question, "Who am I that I should do this?" And God's answer to that question, "I will be with you." Now, what kind of an answer is that? It seems like kind of a strange answer, but in fact, it is the right one. You see, God is saying that his identity is tied to God's identity. And because that is true, he will be able to do all that God has asked him to do. Because his identity is God's identity, he's able to complete this task that God has given him. And isn't that what all of us need? That is absolutely incredible and a truth that all of us can lay hold of. You see, Moses was the ideal person. He was raised in the Egyptian court. He saw the people suffering. God's hand was on him from the time that he was a baby. But all of that wasn't enough for Moses. He still felt inadequate. He had everything. He had all the right things intact, but he still comes up to this task and he feels still inadequate. You see, Moses didn't need higher self-esteem. He needed a greater sense of God's presence. It wasn't more self-esteem that Moses needed. He needed a greater sense of God's presence. You see, in the years that followed this story, if you would have asked an Israelite, "Who is God?" they would have told you this story, this very story that we read today. Who is God? They would have taken you right here. This is the story of Exodus, is where they would have gone. Fast forward over 1,000 years, and an Israelite man comes onto the scene, and he makes this claim. He says, "Before Abraham was born, I am." That's John 8:58. Jesus was making this claim in the midst of them. He was claiming to be, "I am who I am." In Jesus, God has come down, just as he said he would in Exodus 3:8. He rolled up his sleeves, he put on human flesh, he entered our world to rescue his people. You see, God is self-defining. And his ultimate definition is the life, death, and resurrection of his son Jesus. At the cross, we see the holiness of God in his judgment on Jesus. We see the power of God in his defeat of Satan and his raising of his son. And we see the grace of God because Jesus was judged in our place and he rose to give us new life. God defines himself and his definition is Jesus. This morning, we are going to give you a visible display of these truths that we have been talking about. Three people are going to be baptized this morning, and they are going to give us a visible, physical display of the inward reality of new life that has happened to them. And that's one of the beautiful things about baptism, is that we literally show on the outside, through this visible act, what has happened on the inside. In these three people's lives, God has reached down as he promised that he would. He grabbed a hold of their attention. They listened, they heard, they saw, and their lives were transformed.